Just days before a deadline for public input, we're learning more about the preferred alternative for the future of the Waikiki War Memorial Natatorium. State Health Director Bruce Anderson, who grew up swimming in the pool, talks to us about his concerns about the proposed deck. Shoring the structure up may mean driving scores of pilings 65 feet into the reef, and he has concerns about silt in the pool affecting the Marine Conservation District next door.
In the past, we've had concerns about water quality and safety of the pool. It was proposed as an enclosed swimming pool, much the way it was when it was first constructed. And even then, problems with water quality, turbidity was always high from sediments being stirred up in the pool. And I remember swimming there as a kid, and we never saw the bottom. In fact, it was just a murky pool. The slide and the platforms were what attracted most of the kids and others to the area. And it truly was a nice venue for getting together and enjoying those activities. But it never was a great swimming venue. Even the swimmers I know who swam in the Olympics said it was hard to swim there and it could never see the bottom. Of course, it wouldn't be sanctioned as a competitive pool these days, given that all those pools are freshwater. Saltwater has a different buoyancy and wouldn't be appropriate. In any event, getting back to the most current proposal, it does address some of the issues as it relates to water quality. We wouldn't worry as much about staph infections. It does allow for some open circulation. Actually, it's an elevated pool deck, which allows for water to pass underneath the deck and refresh water in the pool. However, the biggest problem in the past probably would remain, and that is the accumulation of sediment. The pool acts as a sediment catchment basin. When the turbid water gets into that area, it's calm, and all the solids settle out, and you get a layer of sediment. And over the years, in fact, even over the first year or so the pool was in operation, originally it started accumulating and continued throughout the time the pool was there. I see this as an ongoing issue. It would be very hard to clean out the sediment, and it naturally will occur. There's nothing anyone can do about that. It gets stirred up by the surf and comes in and then settles, and that's the way everything works, except that it can't go anywhere because it's settling into a basin that would collect the sediment, and over time it would be suspended anytime it was agitated, which is what happened in the past. So that's the biggest issue. It does not meet our pool rule definition. That was a key issue. We do have specific rules for saltwater swimming pools, which require, among other things, that you be able to see a disc at the bottom of the pool. That would be very difficult with the original proposal, and it's hard to know whether that would have been a problem here. The reason for that is you need to recover someone if they sink and before they drown. In fact, there were at least one death at the old natatorium because they couldn't find the individual until it was too late. So being able to see the bottom is a key safety issue. But as far as water quality goes, it should meet the coastal water quality standards. No reason to think it wouldn't. It would be just as safe to swim there as it would at Kaimana. But the turbidity issue is still going to be a problem as I see it. I think they're going to need to think through that. And I would also question its utility. It's a variant of the old pool that will make it difficult to swim. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to be constructed, but they talked about bars around the perimeter of the pool, which would be presumably to keep sharks and other things that you don't want in a pool out of the pool, and yet allow for water to be circulating. But that seems to be a safety issue in my mind, but that's for others to best determine. There are some issues that need to be looked at, but the key issue for many was whether or not it would meet our swimming pool rule definition. And it does not, and therefore would not be subject to the very stringent standards we have for public swimming pools. It's a very large pool, and even when we had hundreds of kids swimming there, public school children and others swam there regularly, and it would be hard to keep track of where everyone was at any time. And the problem with a pool where you can't see the bottom is if someone gets in trouble and sinks, you're not going to see them and be able to recover them in time. So lifeguards would certainly help to minimize the risk, but they would still be there. And again, I would question the utility of the pool. I remember I actually learned to swim at Kaimana Beach, and the reason for that was it was too dangerous to learn how to swim in the pool. And finally, after we learned how to swim in the ocean, we would have our time in the pool, and we watched very carefully, and by then we were able to swim confidently, and as far as I know, no one got in trouble during those last days of your swimming lessons. But it was not a nice venue for swimming as it was. I'll add one other item that I think might need to be considered, and that is talking to Bruce Carlson and some of the others who ran the Waikiki Aquarium. That's where they go to catch box jellyfish. They could almost always find them there. They apparently settle to the bottom, and they come up during the full moon, and as we all know, I think it's 6, 7, 8 days, I can't remember exactly when, after the full moon, they're up on the surface where they may get into contact with people swimming. But box jellyfish might be an issue. I don't remember them being a problem back in the when the pool was used regularly, but things have changed since then. Those sorts of things, I think, need to be investigated more thoroughly. And obviously, we, I think, need to look at alternatives as well. But this pool is not going to violate any of the pool rules that we have because it simply doesn't meet the definition of a public swimming pool. We look at the existing pool now, although it hasn't been maintained in decades, it's full of sand and sediment. I can't see that not continuing to be an issue. It's going to be a huge maintenance problem. Even if it's a soft bottom with beach sand, you know, you're going to have sediment on top of the sand, and there's no way to avoid that. That's going to happen naturally. And I don't know how you could possibly remove that material. I can't think of any mechanical way you could do it that would be effective.
So it's just going to spread out in that area.
Yeah, and again, the risk from a safety standpoint is that silt gets resuspended. That's what happened when people were swimming there in the past. You'd get hundreds of kids in there and others, and they would agitate the sediment, and it would get suspended in the water column, and it was a murky green pool. It looked like pea soup some days. That's probably what will happen again. Maybe not to the same extent, but certainly is an issue that planners need to think about.
Apparently, the proposal calls for putting pilings in along the reef.
No, they have to suspend the pool deck somehow, and I presume they'd be pounding down pilings and then suspending the deck on top of those.
Anything from the health department perspective on that at all?
Well, they would have to. They'd have to implement best management practices during any construction there. Probably put in silt curtains, minimize the amount of sediment, construction debris that would be suspended in the area. The pool area around the pool is a marine protected area. It has the highest levels of protection. We were very concerned when that fishing vessel went aground last year, and it sat there for many months and did have adverse impacts on corals and other things that are in the area. That area is under stress as it is, and any construction activity there would have to implement very stringent measures to prevent any damage to corals and other marine life that's in the vicinity. The point is that area around the natatorium is a very important area from a marine protection standpoint, and any construction activity there would be scrutinized to be sure that it wasn't adversely impacting the nearby environment.
Anderson was also the acting or administrator for the Department of Land and Natural Resources Aquatics Division. He made reference to the fishing vessel Pacific Paradise that ran aground at Kaimana Beach last year. This month, the Department of Land and Natural Resources recommended fining the boat owner more than $300,000 because of the damage to the reef. Here's Brian Nielsen, the acting administrator of the Division of Aquatic Resources, detailing the fine at a recent land board meeting.
The damage to natural resources, to break that down, so for stony coral, there was 18 coral colonies impacted, and that's the low estimate using a 90% confidence interval, since because there's so much damage in the area, you don't know what was there before the impact, so we have to survey surrounding areas, take an average of those coral counts, and then we use the lower end of that average. So that was 18 stony coral colonies. And then in terms of the live rock, we estimated 301 meters squared of high-value live rock and 1,060 meters squared of low-value live rock. So these are the reef areas that don't necessarily have stony corals growing on them, but it's still important reef habitat. It has crustaceous coralline algae, the pink stuff that you see all over the reef, which is a precursor to coral growth, limu or algae, invertebrates. That's what we consider live rock. And so the total value was $2,015 for stony coral, $266,200 of live rock for a total of $268,215. Other damages and costs that we considered is damage to the public for a temporary loss of use of the nearshore waters fronting Caimana Beach, resulting in 500-yard security zone established by the Coast Guard, so that area wasn't usable by the public at one of our most popular beaches in Waikiki for 58 days, and we estimated that to be $17,835. We arrived at that estimate based on a NOAA economic study. Other damage costs was the cost of investigation, so staff time, which included 9 DAR staff, 446 hours, totaled $11,879.59. Operational costs, 5 boat trips, scuba tank refills, another $2,564, totaling $14,443.59. So in summary of the fines and costs, we had resource value of $268,215, public loss of use $17,835, cost of investigation $14,443.59, to a total of $300,493.59.
That was Brian Nielsen, Acting Aquatics Resource Administrator for the Department of Land and Natural Resources. The company is appealing the fine and has filed for a contested case hearing that will trigger a lengthy process before a final fine is levied. The company had taken steps to remove the boat, but the plan didn't work, and it ended up costing more than it planned.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar and Locations.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. If you've been to see the Honolulu City Lights at Honolulu Hale, then you're familiar with the jolly couple who greet you with a big shaka on the way in. That's right, we're talking about the Mr. and Mrs. Claus, the giant figures that are generally taking up residence on the corner of South King and Punchbowl Streets. They're both the products of several talented artists who spent days on end carving round bellies and relaxed limbs to make them look like they could spring to life at any moment. For more than two decades, Shaka Santa and Mele Claus have greeted thousands of visitors at the Honolulu City Lights Festival. They are joined by Christmas cheer in the form of a 50-foot Norfolk pine illuminated by ornaments, as well as an electric light parade, a wreath display, and a whole cadre of Santa's pals, including Rudolph and toy bears. Santa is bare-chested and throws the shaka, and Mele Claus has tucked up her aloha print mu'u to dip her toes into the fountain water. What we want to know is, who is the artist or the sculptor responsible for the creation? Well, here's a hint. He's a former city and county of Honolulu Department of Parks, Recreation's artist and craft specialist. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Highway Inn Hawaiian Food in Kaka'ako, Waipahu, and Bishop Museum, with combo plates featuring lau lau, beef stew, or kalua pig. Menus at myhighwayinn.com.
On Saturday the 22nd, Leche de Tigre, a band out of the Big Island, is coming to town. If you're looking for an alternative to jingling bells, snowmen, and reindeer this season, HPR offers Leche de Tigre's rock band backline, Latin gypsy funk instrumentals, and multilingual vocalists. Get your seats for their Atherton debut at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Public Utilities Commission Chairman Randy Iwase steps down at the end of this month. He navigated through a tumultuous time when the energy giant NextEra offered to buy up Hawaiian Electric Company. That deal would have been the largest in Hawaii history. Those hearings lasted some 3 weeks, and in the end, the commission voted the deal down. Iwase stopped by our studios to reflect back and talk about what lies ahead for his successor.
We wanted to make sure that whatever the decision was going to be based on the facts and the evidence and the law. I think we did that. It was not something to treat as something trifle. It probably was the biggest acquisition merger case in our history. You know, you go back and look at Hawaiian Electric, Maui Electric, and Helco, the Big Islands Electric Company. They were, I think it was Hawaiian Electric first, chartered during the kingdom. One of the others chartered while we were a territory or republic, and another when we were a territory. And so this was something, like I said, that had historic roots. We wanted to make sure we did it right on the law. But most importantly, was to make sure that this was going, if it was approved, it was going to be a deal that would benefit not only the ratepayers, but the state as well, the public, because the ramifications are widespread, you know, it's jobs. So we took that task very seriously. It was about 21, 22 days of hearings. One person had said that we had over 100,000 pieces of documents. We went from 8:30 to 4:30 every day. One thing I can say about that case is we had 31 parties in that case, most of them represented by attorneys.
Is it interveners? Interveners, friends of?
Interveners, participants, mostly interveners. I think it was all interveners. That the how they conducted themselves at the hearing was very civil, very businesslike. We also went, I wanted to make sure that the public had input. So although we didn't have to, we had listening sessions on every island, including Kauai, which was not involved in this merger application. And even there, and I've been around politics a while, it can get real ugly, name-calling, uncivil. But the public conducted themselves very well. They knew this was serious stuff. This is not a time to try to grab a mic and make noise. So it was, from that perspective, from that experience, it was something that I enjoyed.
And there were some tense times. I know you had legal counsel Tom Gorak. There were issues with his appointment on the commission.
You know, Tom Gorak, and I've said it before, is probably one of the most qualified, if not the most qualified nominee that was presented for confirmation. He is very smart. He is not only in the law, he had a wealth of experience in the utility field, on the consumer advocate side, on the utility side, on the commission side, and came here to Hawaii to retire and was brought out of retirement. So it was, that is the most disappointing event that occurred during my now coming up 4 years on the PUC.
Is it the turmoil around that?
Yeah, and how it was played and the accusations that were made. It got personal. And again, having been around politics, I know it's hard to not get personal, but you shouldn't. I think it was John Kennedy that said that civility is not a sign of weakness, that sincerity is always subject to proof. And so you can have civil, objective, factual discussions, something, by the way, that's greatly missed in politics, state, mostly very much on the national level. And so nothing gets done, and it's hard to swing at shadows.
But then just reflecting over that case, you believe at the end of the day it was the right thing.
Going back to NextEra?
Yes.
Oh, yes. You know, there are legal requirements that you have to meet, that you are fit, willing, and able to perform, and that the merger would be in the public interest. Now, those are easy words. It's hard when you get down into the weeds to define it. But after 21 days and 100,000 pieces of documents, going over all of that, with a tremendous staff at the PUC, going through all of that document, all those documents, Yes, I feel very comfortable that we did the right thing. Now we move forward.
You did have some staff challenges at the time, too.
Yeah, when I started, the PUC had 35, I believe, employees, which includes administrative and clerical staff on the one hand and the professional staff on the other. So we had, and it was done by my predecessor and the legislature, creating more positions for the PUC. About, I think it was up to 60, all told. And I went on a hiring spree. I just went out and we need these people. And that is something I am very proud of today because we hired a lot of, you know, there are a lot of young people at the PUC. You know, they may not have had a wealth of experience in the utility field, but they are committed, they are energetic, they have a sense of public service, they have a sense of doing right for the public. They're doing that job now. And so we're up to about 50, we're up to 59 now.
So you feel you leave with, in good hands?
Oh, yes. The professional staff is outstanding. The administrative clerical staff is outstanding, and we are operating quite smoothly now. I can truly say that it was an ohana, and I'm glad that we got to that point.
And you folks did have a pretty intense schedule. You had a number of those large solar utility scale projects. We had the issues with Sun Edison, and there was lots of turmoil over those massive projects.
People say that now that NextEra is gone, it's a lot easier. It's not. NextEra was a big elephant in the room. But this past year, we've not had rate cases for the last couple of years. We had 10 or 11 of them. That's the first thing. And those are intense technical financial analysis that has to be done by staff, including HECO, MECO, and HELCO, and Young Brothers, and the gas company, which have broad reach with the public and impact on the public. On the other side is what I call the blueprint dockets, the cases, performance-based regulation, distributive energy resources, which is the PVs on the roof. And to set, why I call it a blueprint is what is going to come out of those cases will set a plan of action to move forward to achieve what Governor Ige constantly talks about, achieving the renewable energy goal by 2045 of 100% renewable. So we have the rate cases on the one hand, and we have these blueprint cases on the other hand. They're also intensive. We have technical conference. We are asking stakeholders to participate because no one person in this state has all of the answers. There's got to be a recognition that climate change is real. It is happening. And it will impact adversely our future. And when we talk about that, and it's something that's always been foremost to me, is that we do not screw up the future for our young people. And so when we look at this renewable energy stuff, I am confident that we can achieve renewable our renewable energy goals by 2045 for all the islands. Oahu is going to be a little more problematic. But on some days, we were in Kauai about 3 or 4 weeks ago. On some days, they are at 97% renewables. The Big Island and Maui are somewhere between 40 and 50% renewables. They're going to exceed the 2025 or something like that. I forget with all these numbers. But they're going to achieve that. Oahu is a little more problematic. We have 4/5 of the population, over 1 million people. The land area, 600 square miles. And you're going to run into, not in my backyard, because of the windmills, wind turbines, the solar panels, it requires acres. And we don't have that. And so we're going to have to look at things like energy efficiency, which you can do, you know, LED lights, turn down your air conditioner at certain times of the day, use your electricity at certain times of the day, a time of use. Those things are going to be very important on Oahu, but we have to achieve that because we have no option. We just saw an article in the paper the other day, the federal government's own agency, the melting of the ice in the Arctic, which confirms the Inconvenient Truth movie by Al Gore. It is happening, and we've got to stop it. I don't think you can sound the alarm loud enough, given all of the data that is now coming out.
That was Randy Owase, outgoing chairman of the Public Utilities Commission, reflecting on his tenure and looking forward to the challenges ahead.
find HBR's on-air membership drives exciting? Would you excel at organizing events to engage our community? Are you a whiz at time management and a details person? Then check out the new position in our membership department, Pledge and Listener Experience Producer. Details on the employment opportunities page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Applications due by January 31st.
Honolulu Civil Beat gives us our reality check with a new development on the cloud hanging over the city prosecutor's office. Reporter Terry Lankford joins us this morning. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
So you folks got a hold of an interesting email. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's interesting for a couple of reasons. It comes from HPD's Chief Susan Ballard, and she is writing to the city's managing director, Roy Amamiya, because the mayor is on vacation this week. And in it, she says she's uncomfortable having the prosecuting attorney included in their monthly public safety meetings because of what has been reported widely as a target letter against him, notifying him that he is now part of an ongoing federal investigation.
So what does she say about her concerns?
She says she's uncomfortable because there's so much sensitive information that are shared at these meetings with the mayor. This is a monthly meeting, a public safety meeting between the mayor, the chief of police and fire departments, emergency management, and also the prosecuting attorney's office.
Right. And I know that there is just, you know, lots of concern about, you know, what might happen if any indictments are handed down and what effect it might have on a number of cases that the office has handled.
That's right. So far, Keith Kaneshiro has really not addressed the target letter. He's neither confirmed nor denied it. But this is kind of the first hard and fast evidence we have in this email that at least the police chief believes it's real, because she says he has been sent a target letter from the FBI.
Yeah, that is a concern, just like you said, because of the sensitive information and the cases that may come up before that office.
That's right. And, you know, everything has to move forward. These cases have to move forward. The investigations have to go forward. And, you know, obviously the chief doesn't want someone who's having to deal with their own possible defense in the midst of having to investigate cases going forward.
And we saw what happened with the former police chief, Alui Kealoha, and, of course, his wife, Catherine Kealoha, who was a deputy prosecutor in Keith's office until just recently.
That's right. They both face trial on corruption and bank fraud charges next year, along with five HPD officers.
So it's really just uncomfortable for a lot of these law enforcement agencies just because of this dark cloud. I mean, I know the chief has said that, you know, innocent until proven guilty, but it's just awkward.
It's very awkward. You've got the defense bar who would like him to step down. You've got the police chief now saying she doesn't want him in any future discussions coordinating with law enforcement in the city. So right now, we don't know what's going to happen. He could step down. He's innocent until proven guilty, but it makes it quite awkward for the department itself, the prosecuting attorney's office.
Right, and I know they still have the petition that will go before the court impeachment of Kaneshiro.
Right. This would be, so far, if this goes forward, this would be the first time that impeachment proceedings would go forward. There have been a couple of attempts in the state's history for impeachment, but the person involved either resigned or it was dismissed. But we have a hearing on this matter filed by Tracy Yashimura on January 8th.
Right, so we'll have to see what happens. Thanks so much, Terry.
Thank you.
That was reporter Terry Lankford with today's Reality Check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
At the beginning of the week, Governor David Ige outlined his proposed spending plan for his last 2 years in office. HPR's Wayne Yoshioka is here to take a closer look at what we can expect down the road.
Hi, Catherine. The governor's proposal is to spend $8 billion in state general funds in fiscal year 2020 and $8.3 billion in 2021. Now, with the federal and the other sources of funding, the spending plan is basically $15.4 billion in 2020 and $15.7 billion in 2021. But I think the key to his executive budget requests is that he lowered spending below the State Council on Revenue's projected general fund growth. The council projected 5% growth, but the governor lowered it to 3.5%, 1.5 percentage points less. As we all know, each percentage point is about $100 million, so 1.5% lower equals $150 million less in spending. And here's the governor's explanation.
If you look at the revenues that actually received in the first 5 months, they've been all over the map. For the first quarter in this fiscal year, they were running at 0% increase. And so the concern that we have is that the 5% that's projected by the council may not be achieved. And if we build a budget at 5% and we arrive at 3.5, then we would be required to submit a whole bunch of cuts to the legislature after they convene.
So that's really unusual to go $150 million less. But the governor says that more than half of the state funding pays for fixed costs, which include public employee pensions, health benefits, Medicaid, and other state loans. So his spending plan for 2020 and 2021 includes a number of things, mostly for affordable housing, homelessness, and preschool and early college programs.
So he's really being very conservative.
Very conservative. But if you look at some of the things that are happening now, where November, the tourism rates are down, and, you know, we find that 3,712 people have left Hawaii and, you know, no longer are generating taxes. So maybe he's right.
So how are you thinking that the lawmakers will look at his spending plan?
I think, him being conservative, if he doesn't spend the $150 million, I'm sure the legislature will find a way to spend $150 million. So it's going to be a touch-and-go session. I think it's not even done yet, but one of his construction projects includes $38 million to build girl locker rooms at public schools and that $125 million in state matching funds for a federally funded flood mitigation project along the Alawai Canal. But House Finance Committee Chair Sylvia Luke says the Alawai is a city and county responsibility, not state. And she says the legislature really intends to take a different approach this coming session. Here's her explanation.
What we're going to do is performance-based budget. So for everything that is requested, there needs to be good justification of why we're doing what we need to do, and we need to be more responsive to the public. So whether you're taking the 3.5% or 5% for us, it really depends on how much you're planning to spend.
Really, that's not a change because to really spend money, there needs to be a good justification, and they are, you know, responsive to the public. So I don't know how much that's changed.
Well, I know we talked about this a little bit with the Honolulu Civil Beat earlier this week. And, we've heard Representative Luke talk about this, though, in previous sessions. She's kind of hinted at this.
Correct. And I think, maybe they'll try to enact this, but there's a lot of bad blood because during the election, Sylvia Luke and, even Della Albalati supported Colleen Hanabusa. So it's going to be a tough House session.
Right. And in the governor's budget, I know you had pointed out that they had put in some money to build lockers for girls in the schools. And we just had that ACLU lawsuit filed against the DOE.
Right. And $14 million, I think, in 2020 and $16 million or so in 2021. So that'll be a new game changer, I think, for the girls in public school.
And then the other project that you brought up, the Olawa Canal, I mean, that's got to go because the federal government has already put in some money for flood mitigation.
Right. The federal government put in $345 million, so we need the state matching funds in order to get that money. So we'll see how it transpires. We've got a lot of things happening. The Council on Revenues with their new general fund projection is January 9th. So
right.
We'll see.
They've already started some of the budget hearings, too, at the ledge.
Correct. And, you know, the legislature opens on the 16th, and the governor's state of the state to the legislature is on January 22nd. So
okay.
A lot of things will change.
Right. We'll see what he gets into detail in that state of the state. Thanks so much, Wayne.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Wayne Yoshioka. You can find all his stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. If you're familiar with the Honolulu City Lights Festival at Honolulu Hale, then you know that the jolly couple that greets you as you make your way toward the elaborately decorated giant Norfolk pine tree up front, that Shaka Santa and Mele Claus look like they could spring to life at any moment and burst into your favorite Christmas carol. But the artist, Mike Smith, says they're actually done with their work in preparing for the season of giving, and they are taking time off to relax here in Hawaii, where you can just kind of hang out, go to the beach, get a tan, you know, just hang loose. Well, they look timeless. Mr. and Mrs. Claus are more than two decades old. Hard to believe. Shaka Santa is 26 and Mele Claus is 21. And according to Smith, it took the mutual collaboration of a close-knit crew with some expertise on constructing large-scale art installations. They created both figures with styrofoam, cement, polymer, and fiberglass adhesive to make it last. And this all took place in an old warehouse in Campbell Industrial Park, where they even had a mock-up of the Honolulu Hale Water Fountain. And congrats to our winner, Jasper from Hilo. Hey, you got it right. Shaka bra. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Mele Kaliki Maka and happy holidays. This is Bela Fleck. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
Today is regarded as winter solstice. It's the shortest day of the year in the northern half of the world and the longest night. It'll be followed by a full moon, what some call the cold moon. And so we thought it fitting that a new segment that we're launching will focus on the Hawaiian lunar calendar. We plan to take you out and about to talk story in Hawaii's gardens and forests. Did you know that this past Tuesday was the best day to plant anything but trees? Well, we headed out to a lush corner in a East Honolulu neighborhood to find out more. Well, we're here in the valley, and we have the honor of spending the morning with our gracious garden lady, Heidi Bornhorst, and we're here to talk about the lunar calendar.
The moon affects things. It affects plants, it affects people, it affects the ocean, it affects the tides. The moon is a super important part of our life. And so I always would observe it and kind of want to know, like, for example, my husband and I were married on a full moon. We thought that was romantic. So I'm like, every month, happy anniversary, love. But, you know, like, people will ask you, oh, Heidi, when is the best time to come to Hawaii for the most flowers? And I used to think about that, and I'd say anytime, but it's kind of like May, summer. But if you want to be more specific, like you're planning your wedding or you're planning a giant flower show, and you want things to be in bloom, May or a summer month, and the week before and up to the full moon, you're going to have the maximum buds and flowering. After the full moon, things tend to drop. And it's that the moon is closer, so it's pulling up the sap and the juices and everything, and then after, it's going down. Like, used to be, when is the last flowering of plumeria? And it used to be the last full moon of November. You'd see pretty much the last flowers, and then pow. But not anymore, thank you, climate change. But it still is affected by the moon.
So it has to do with what, then, the moisture in the earth? And the pull,
I think the moon is closer, just a little bit closer. And so, again, I just visualize it as like looking at a tide chart. High tide, low tide. The moon is pulling up the sap and then letting it go. And years ago, my really smart boss, Paul Weizik, who was the director of Botanical Gardens, we had this project for Hawaiian-style xeriscapes, less thirsty gardens. So, and he goes, it doesn't have to be cactus and rocks. It can be Hawaiian style, native Hawaiian plants, old Kama'aina favorites, and new plants that aren't a pest. So most of this was at our Cocoa Crater Botanic Garden. And we had all these test gardens and all this different irrigation. And one assignment he gave to me as the horticulturist is to make some new hybrids, to make a more unthirsty bougainvillea, a more unthirsty plumeria, and a willy willy that would bloom for longer and be more drought tolerant. All those plants are naturally drought tolerant, but we were crossing them with something that was extremely drought tolerant. Like we have this kind of ugly bougainvillea from driest Peru. So that, you know, would make it a better drought tolerant plant. And I was having such a hard time. Nothing was working. And so I went to my grandma garden mentor, Mae Moyer, and I said, what do you think? And she gave me all kinds of insight, including pollination or anything to do with flowers and above ground parts of the plants. You do that on the waxing moon as the moon is growing bigger. So I did what she said, and I got a better pollination percentage than the world expert.
Wow.
Yeah. And so then she had all kinds of writings about it, but her basic concept is for flowering, for pollination of flowers, for doing air layers, grafting, you do that on the waxing moon. And then things that are involved the dark, which are like roots under the ground, you do that on the waning moon. So you have a lovely plant that you've tried and tried to grow from cuttings with no success. First, get it in good health. You know, water it, mulch it, get the evil alien grass away from the bottom of it. Get it healthy, and then be watching that moon calendar. And 1 week after the full moon is a good time to make the cuttings, because that's the moon is going dark, so the dark things under the ground are going to work better.
So I just picked up a calendar, a lunar calendar from the Bishop Museum gift shop, and it was put together by the Hawaiian Civic Clubs. And it is great because it talks about fishing and planting. And I think for this week, they said it's a great time to plant anything but a tree.
And again, to look at those closely and extrapolate, because often they'll say, today is a good day for planting niu, ko, and mai'a, or today's a good day for ulu. And then when they talk about planting a root thing, like kalo, uwala, so that's, again, the light and dark of the moon, I think. But those days are more specific, broken down to every day and every phase of the moon.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, you know, to think that I guess over time, they just figured it out.
Observing. I'm amazed sometimes about how people do not observe the natural world, how they don't know that first comes a flower, then it has to get pollinated, then it got a fruit. And then you have to be patient and do all your things to get it to grow. To really go outside at night and look at the moon and look at the stars and look at the wind and look at the tides. It's such a gift we have in Hawaii that we can do that. You know, turn off all the devices. Go outside.
Put your phone away.
Yeah. And the other thing is to get up early and wake up for sunrise. And that's, you know, just like how the moon calendar is, this time of month, this season, and it's place-based too. It's where you are on the island. Are you in a wet area? Are you in a dry area? Are you Mauka? Are you Makai?
Hey, we're sitting here at the back of the valley. We're looking up and we're seeing the ridge and we see albizia trees.
And some kukui.
Yes.
And there's some natives, like I love to just look at all the different green and the different light at times of day. And you know, I'm a native Hawaiian plant person, so I always look, is there a native in there? Look
struggling
at all that,
to survive,
look at all that
with all
stuff
the
that they planted with a good intent to not have the mountains wash away. But if only they had planted more natives, which now we're kind of trying to turn that around.
Right. And I think, you know, what we're seeing a lot of the efforts toward reforestation in some of the areas where the pristine forests used to thrive and now need help. Lots of folks can now buy native plants at the stores and they can put them in their gardens.
Right. To have native nurseries. It's so awesome. Like, you know, when I was getting my master's, my own professor said, oh, you know, they're a bunch of weeds. It's a fad. Make them look good with your macro lens. And I'm like, well, you know, it's been this fad in California for about 10 or 20 years, and they are drought tolerant. And now that fad is keep going. Like, I love that other people are writing books about it and people are growing natives.
And it's healing the land, isn't it?
Yeah, yep, to grow natives. And I believe in mixing them up because we all need to eat. And there's, you know, because we didn't have, our natives are just birds, the Hawaiian bat, the monk seal. We don't have a lot of things that are big things to eat. Like all the good starchy Hawaiian crops were brought here by canoe. I like to grow both, and partly you get less pests if you mix everything up. Like growing a monoculture of all one kind of thing.
Bad news, because you could get pests and then they all die out.
Right. And mixed up, diverse, how the forest grows, and how Hawaiians and Polynesians have traditionally done their gardening. It's called an agroforest. Everything, it looks mixed up, but there's a rhyme and a reason and a science to it of companion planting. What grows well together, grow different things, and even in neighborhoods. And we're kind of seeing this in our neighborhood.
I love that in this valley, you've got streets that are named after flowers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did not realize that what neighborhoods have official street trees, or,
yeah.
Or explain that.
Yeah, there is the Division of Urban Forestry for years has planted street trees, and there's a design to it. You know, they have landscape architects and good arborists on staff. So certain trees were planted in certain neighborhoods, and as the science gets better, some things we don't plant anymore. They're hazardous, they get too big, they have a slippery seed. Like our neighborhood, the official tree is magnolia, which is a bit hard to get started, but then it's the ideal street tree. It hardly drops anything. The flowers are beautiful.
The leaves are beautiful
for decorating, and it's slow growing. So you save money in not having to come and trim it all the time.
Yeah, I was delighted to learn about the magnolia leaves because we were making a lei for the Aloha Festival's parade. It was just beautiful, the coppery in the bottom of the leaf and then the bright green, glossy.
And they last pretty well.
They're very hardy.
We were doing a decorating of Washington Place and put out the call for all kinds of magnolia. And then if the flower gets pollinated, the seed pod is really neat. It looks kind of like a pine cone, but it has bright little red fruit.
As far as the lunar calendar, are there proverbs about the phases of the moon? What can you share with us?
Yes, there's a lot, and people are looking into it again. There's a really Akamai researcher on Maui, Kale Nu'uhiva, and she's going back through the Kaulana Mahina, the moon calendar, and the newspapers. those old Hawaiian newspapers in Olelo, Hawaii, inform us about some amazing things.
So going right to the source and refreshing our memories about, look, this is the history, and it's written down, and we need to keep it alive.
Right, right. And, you know, again, you know the one thing that we can do to combat climate change? Plant a tree. Plant a tree, maintain it. People think it's some kind of cosmic, haha, hippie thing, but trees cool the air around them. They mitigate soil runoff. They give us oxygen. If you plant a good one, like a breadfruit or a coconut or a banana,
it gives you food forever.
Like I'm really an advocate of planting ulu or breadfruit. And again, it looks like the moon.
There you go.
But again, it is science that that is something we can do. And as an arborist and a horticulturist, I'm always like, plant the right tree in the right place. Don't plant some poor little thing. Plant it with intent. Get the whole family or community involved. Because to plant it in your own garden, to plant it at your school and take care of it. Street trees, farms and gardens. Every place that we can plant a tree, we and our children and our next generations are really doing something to heal and cool our planet. The ocean is too hot, and our land is too hot. Too much cement, too much concrete.
Green it up.
And people cutting down big old trees to build something.
Okay, well, Heidi Bornhorst, thank you. Hawaii's Gardens and Forests, we're digging in.
We were talking to our dear garden spirit, Heidi Bornhorst, as we break ground on our reoccurring segment that we'll add to our New Year lineup. And by the way, the stars are lining up to celebrate, and the full moon will come with a meteor shower. So if it's clear, you might get a glimpse of falling stars. And with that, our wish from all of us here at The Conversation and Hawaii Public Radio is that you have a safe, Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year. And as we sign off, we want to let you know next week we're preempted for the holiday, and for the last part of 2018 and into the new year, we'll rebroadcast earlier segments of The Conversation. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn-Grusby. Backyard theme, John DeMello. Thanks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us Monday and pick up The Conversation.